This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 63rd State House District includes parts of both Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties. There will be a new representative in that district next year because current Representative Dave Maturin was defeated in a Republican primary. John LaPietra is the Green Party candidate in the 63rd State House District. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Give yourself a little bit of an introduction here. Tell people about your background and what you would like to do if you were to be elected to the State House.
Oh, goodness. Well, I will have been an attorney for 10 years as of October. At least that's when the word of the bar exam passing got through. Before that, I've had a couple other careers. I spent about 10 years working for state, county, regional, and local governments. About 10 years in the private sector, and 10 years in nonprofits. So I have, I think, a fairly wide-ranging background that helps me understand where a lot of people are coming from and what a lot of their lives are like. My top priority, if when elected, would be to get Michigan out of dead last place in one very important area, the Center for Public Integrity. Has flunked Michigan twice in its studies of state government accountability and integrity. And in fact, last time in 2015, we were placed dead last. This doesn't fit with the state constitution's Article 1, Section 1, which says all political power is inherent in the people. Government is instituted for their mutual, let me see if I get the right order here, equal benefit, security, and protection. That's pretty well in line with government of the people being by the people and for the people. I think that all government is of the people, but unless it's done by the people, it can't be for the people. And that's the problem we have.
So what exactly then does the state need to do, or what exactly does a state lawmaker need to do to change that accountability ranking and do have a government which is of, by, and for the people?
Well, there are, in that study, a lot of other states' best practices, and we can learn from them whether we adopt them exactly as they are or improve them or adapt them to our circumstances. We need stronger FOIA and open meeting laws and rules. We need better financial disclosure and stronger conflict of interest rules for our elected officials. And a simple idea, we need to stop letting incumbents of any elected office promote themselves on the public dollar. If you go into the Secretary of State's office to renew your license or your tag or anything else, you will see a lot of information with the current incumbent's name prominently displayed on it. There's no, you don't expect to see her there. You don't expect to get served by her. The only purpose that has is to tell you, I'm here. You want to vote for me.
But it's promotion. But incumbents will always want to communicate with their constituents. We can argue about how much of it is promoting, how much of it is truly useful. But in the course of communicating with constituents, isn't some of that likely to be interpreted by opponents as trying to buff up their image or what have you?
Well, if I'm elected, the seat in the office I will occupy, I know won't be mine. It's only a temp job, basically. And anytime I get information for constituents, which I expect to do and I hope to do, it will come from the office. It won't have my name or picture on it.
So you mentioned strengthening FOIA, Freedom of Information Act.
Yes.
Would you want to make both the governor and the legislature subject to that?
Yes. I also want to make sure that the law is interpreted and applied as it's written, which says that basically the people get the benefit of the doubt, that the burden of proof that something needs to be kept concealed and not open is on those who claim that.
And financial disclosure. You also mentioned financial disclosure, conflict of interest. There's been some reporting about bills which have come forward and lawmakers who had a potential financial stake went ahead and voted. Would you say they shouldn't be allowed to vote, or should we just be aware of the potential financial benefit to them based on how they vote?
My general inclination is to keep them from voting, if possible. Of course, you can't do that until you know what the possible conflicts of interest are. So disclosure is certainly a first step and a necessary step. Sunlight is a disinfectant, but I don't think it's necessarily an entire cure. I don't know that it's necessarily an absolute blanket rule that has to be made, but I do think that at least in some circumstances, voting should not be allowed. And if it is done, then it should be obviously made and put on the record so that voters can know for next time.
Campaign finance, would you want stronger disclosure there as well? What should we know when it comes to the money being given to politicians?
I think a fair number of the rules we have in place are good. I do think that there are some more that are needed. Going back to somewhat to an earlier point, actually, I got a couple of mailings from Mr. Maturin, or at least with his name and picture prominently on them, signed for and so on, promoting some of the things he's done for the district or various groups in the district. But it didn't say that it was from his campaign, and it didn't say that it was a state-funded piece of literature, because it didn't have the required disclosure about how much state money cost to put out the pieces. I believe I found out that it actually came through the House Republican Caucus, which is a legitimate organization. But I do think they have somewhat lighter rules for their disclosure, and I would want to see more disclosure of those areas as well.
In other words, who's contributing to the House Republican Caucus fund?
All right, and that the piece itself is coming from the House Republican Caucus, and so either it is state money, and taxpayers are funding it, or it's coming from campaign contributors, and here's where you look for it.
There have been some spots in the 63rd district where PFASs have been found in water.
Yes.
If you're a state lawmaker, what would you want to do about that?
Testing is underway in a lot of areas. I think more is needed. I do think a very strong standard is needed. I think, again, it's somewhat a matter of cart and horse in terms of prevention and detection for the cure, but both, I think, fairly obviously have to be worked at.
You said this, that lowering the standard. In other words, or changing the standard,
yes.
Reducing the amount of these chemicals,
yes.
Parts per trillion allowed in the water. Do you have a number in mind?
Now, I haven't looked at the science myself. I have heard a number of 5 parts per trillion, and that it seems at least plausible to me. Now, I would want some notice before I committed to that firmly, but it does seem like a reasonable number.
What does the state do to prevent the next Flint?
First, repeal emergency manager laws. Second, start finding out where else, as in Benton Harbor and Detroit and other areas, problems already exist, and clean them up as well. And put the people more in charge of their own waters. I think that particularly in Flint, there's an example of where the people knew there were problems and couldn't get the state to act on them. And they didn't have a lot of recourse locally because of the emergency manager law.
What do you think should be done to improve the condition of the state's roads?
Well, one of my past careers involved working a fair amount in transportation planning. It was more transit planning, but I did get to sit in on a lot of road construction project planning as well. And I saw enough to discover for myself what I've since learned, that professional transportation researchers have known since about 1962. They call it the fundamental rule of highway construction. I might call it more the field of dreams rule. If you build it, they will drive. More highway construction leads to more highway trips. It does not really affect traffic congestion. And the more building there is, the more wear and tear there is on the roads. I think what we need is to plan for and build and maintain a sustainable transportation system. We need to make sure our roads are built stronger to last longer, which means having warranties and enforcing them for both new construction, where it is called for, and for repairs. I think it means stopping destroying the roads and our cars with corrosive salts. There are other options. It can be sand. In some situations, it can be other chemicals, which cost more up front, but again, pay for themselves in the long run.
Okay, so you say that building more roads is just going to get more people driving on them. Are you saying never build a new highway?
I would not tend to say never. I don't want to say I never say never, of course, but again, the key to me is sustainability. And a proper understanding of and appreciation for an overall broad system and future needs. One of the Green Party's 10 key values is future focus. It ties into sustainability, and Greens have sometimes advocated for what we call the seventh generation amendment, saying that decisions should be made not with an eye on the bottom line for the next quarterly statement or the next 2 or 5 year plan, but how it will affect things down to the seventh generation.
Well, that section of I-94 that goes through the 63rd District, many people for years have wanted to see it widened in other parts as well of Southwest Michigan to 3 lanes. I mean, does that fall under your idea that, you know, if you widen it 3 lanes, you're just going to get more traffic? Or would that help people get through Southwest Michigan a little bit better if it were a bigger highway?
It would probably work for a short time to improve traffic flow, but in the long run, and probably not necessarily all that long a run, I would think it would tend to be self-defeating again. I know that there is one section here in Kalamazoo that is 3 lanes because of the entrance and exit patterns, right, at WestEdge and all. I do think in selected areas it may be useful, but I don't think it is. I would, before seeing hard numbers and projections that are not just saying, well, we have been having growth, so we want to have more growth, I would tend to say that in general it's not necessary. Maybe there may be some particular spots. I am wary of growth as a constant necessity, as the ideology of the cancer cell, as Edwin Abbey once said.
Of the cancer cell?
Yeah, the growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell.
What would you do about trying to reduce what Michigan residents pay for auto insurance?
The first thing I would want to do is have an open, fully informed discussion about catastrophic claims. It is a fairly unique system, but I think we need to understand the benefits as well as the costs, and we need to know what the costs are and how they are being calculated before we can talk about any particular reforms being done. I am concerned about insurance to some extent anyway. It may not be entirely because I'm an attorney. I've never had a particular case involving an insurance company, but I have had some experience with insurance companies myself, and I have heard some stories on the campaign trail. And I know there's a book by one of the experts in the field called Delay, Deny, Defend. Seems to be a fairly common series of tactics for insurance companies. And although I can understand whereas corporations, they want to defend their own bottom lines. When they affect the rights and the lives of people, I tend to be on the people's side.
So what does the state do about that? I mean, is there some sort of mechanism for examining insurance company practices, regulating them, et cetera?
Well, there are states that have insurance commissions. I don't know how many of them are captive agencies, of course. But again, that might be one of the areas that we can borrow other states' best practices on.
You mentioned it is a unique system in Michigan. Is it your inclination to believe that we're doing something right and the other 49 states should catch up? Or do we have a unique system and maybe it just isn't sustainable in the long run?
Well, I haven't seen enough of the numbers and the facts to know for sure, but I am inclined to think it is a good idea to make sure that people are covered for their catastrophic injuries.
For lifetime.
Yeah.
What do you consider to be a living wage?
One that enables you to live, obviously. I don't know that there is a one figure that can be put on it nationwide or statewide. I do know that the $12 petition would have been a good first step. I also know that even $15 an hour would not have been enough to afford basic housing, according to the studies I've seen across the country and again across the state. I do have a couple of ideas. One on that is borrowed from an old bill that came up in the 1990s. A Minnesota Democrat named Martin Olav Sabo proposed the Income Equity Act. The situation wasn't quite as bad as it is now, but he proposed limiting the amount of CEO, top executive compensation, that could be deducted for business taxes to 25 times the salary of the lowest paid full-time worker. I think something like that could be done here as well. I also think that although Michigan has a clause in its state constitution preventing a graduated progressive income tax, we could make more use of the progressive effect of standard deductions and exemptions, if we put them back in, to raise the floor so that with a compensating increase in the tax rate, but still leaving it at a one tax rate, people up to a higher basic income would still pay no state income taxes.
Well, do you have specific deductions in mind that you would want to bring back, or maybe new ones that we haven't had before in Michigan?
I don't, at the current time, have a lot of specific additional claims on that. I know that we did some rearranging this last time to try and balance off against the changes in the federal income tax, which is also always a problem to balance off. I do know that there's one size fits all deduction now. Might want to try at least consider restoring personal exemptions.
The ballot proposals. Proposal 1 would legalize marijuana for recreational purposes in Michigan. Do you support that?
I join the Green Party in supporting that, yes. There are a number of reasons we support it. One of our values is social justice. And we believe that legalizing marijuana will reduce the impact of the war on drugs and the school-to-prison pipeline. A number of us in the press release we made announcing our official endorsement of the proposal also came out supporting expunging records for people who were convicted only for simple possession offenses, which would also help reduce overcrowding in prisons. We also think that it can be a good opening of the door to industrial hemp, which is another economic impact, as well as the actual tax revenues supporting roads and schools.
Proposal 2 would change the system of redistricting in Michigan. Do you think that voters should approve it?
I think that proposal is somewhat flawed. It is not so much nonpartisan as still bipartisan. It has a lot of ways for the Titanic 2, as I sometimes call them, to control the process and even veto members who are too independent. And even if we were considering independents all in a lump, as opposed to including members of the other 5 parties who will have actually somewhat more of a difficult time qualifying their supporters for the commission, the proportion is a little bit off anyway. The latest Gallup poll I've seen, and they poll them roughly monthly, says that nationwide, 26% of people identify themselves as Republicans, 27% as Democrats, and 44% as independents. And that's including states where people register to vote by party. In Michigan, I've got to figure that it's probably a higher percentage. We may even be an absolute majority. That said, I personally am inclined to accept a little bit of harm to my own party's interests for the benefit of the people, as long as we consider this as a first step. It doesn't, the proposal doesn't also cover reapportionment of county commissions, and I would like to see more of a move myself towards a more proportional system that would give more interests a better chance to be represented.
You say this does some harm to your party. Is the Green Party really any worse off if this passes than it is right now when it comes to drawing the boundaries for state legislature and Congress?
It may not be, but it may be harmed in the idea that people assume that it is being represented when it is not.
Proposal 3, the voting access proposal, includes some things like same-day voter registration. Do you support that?
Again, there are some problems for my own party on that, in that it is fairly well shown that the straight ticket device encourages people to vote for parties that have more of a coverage on the ballot.
Voting for Republicans or Democrats in this case, because they'll probably have candidates for more offices than the Greens or the Libertarians are going to have.
Now, the state does allow people to split their tickets, and even if they've marked that device, to vote for individual candidates otherwise. But not everybody, including not all poll workers, knew that. But again, I am more concerned with the people's benefit than my own. We've talked before about some of the other problems that voters have in the ballot, including the two-minute rule for being in the ballot, in the voting booth. If you take more than 2 minutes, the election inspectors are within their rights to throw you out, although they have discretion to let you stay longer. What we really need now, some of the reforms in the proposal would help, allowing advanced voting or same-day registration could be a help. It would also be helpful if we raised the standard so that instead of the 300 voters having to go through one voting station in a day, we would have near the 80 or 90 that even the Bureau of Elections agrees is appropriate.
And no reason absentee voting. Do you think that's a step in the right direction, that people don't have to give a reason if they're under the age of 65, I think, under the age of 60? Whereas now I think everybody over 60 and older gets a ballot if they want it.
Yeah, if they want. I think that is a good thing. I personally will miss the chance to see people in line at the polling place. I intend to go myself, even though I am 60 myself now. But I think it is a good thing, because I think it's not always easy for people to make time. I think one other reform that would be nice to see would be to make Election Day itself a holiday.
So you've mentioned a couple of times that these things may not be the greatest things for your party. What would be some things with some actions that you would like to see at the state level that would open up the process more, make it more possible for a Green Party candidate, a Libertarian Party candidate, et cetera, to win election at the level of at least state house?
Well, there are some laws in place here and there to limit, on the aim of limiting sore losers that restrict the alternative party's access to the process and the and in some ways, that's also more a matter of process. The Bureau of Elections knew in May that I was the Green Party candidate for the 63rd District. They didn't post a list of people who were qualified for the November ballot until very shortly before the August primary, whereas they'd had people listed as having filed for the primary practically from the start of the year. I don't think there's a problem with that, but I think that anybody who qualifies for the ballot should have an equal amount of state-funded publicity. The primary being state-funded is one is a separate matter, and if we were going by equality entirely, we might want to have either all parties on the ballot get into the primary or all parties be able to choose the primary or conventions and caucuses and have equal information available to the public on all of them. I would also like to see that any public forum using any kind of public space or resources be open to all candidates.
On the ballot,
yes.
In that race.
As soon as they qualify, they should be eligible. In fact, there's been suggestions from some Greens in Ohio, I think, that that candidates be required to debate all their opponents at least sometimes.
Well, this election year, the Libertarians did qualify for the August primary ballot.
Yes, so thanks to Gary Johnson,
right?
Yeah.
So there is an avenue there. I mean, does this say anything going forward about how there is a possibility of getting on the August ballot, or did that just require such a strange concurrence of events that it isn't likely in the future?
I would like to think it will become more likely, but not fast enough. Let's put it that way. I actually think that that there should have been another party in the primary. The Working Class Party.
Why should they have been in the primary?
Because their one statewide candidate actually got more votes than Gary Johnson.
For what?
In the hearing for State Board of Education. The Bureau of Elections, however, changed its position somewhat, at least from what they had told us before, and said that they were only going to look at statewide candidates to meet the threshold, but since the Working Class Party had two congressional candidates who appeared physically above that candidate on the ballot, that was not the top of ticket candidate, and therefore they were not going to consider. Now, there are some complications from getting on the ballot. The Libertarians had to run for precinct delegates to staff their county, district, and state convention. They were at least potentially subject to being taken over by somebody who was dedicated to try and get qualify precinct delegates to control power.
Who were not libertarians.
They could theoretically have
been Green Party members.
Or natural law party who actually wanted to meet for once. Somebody who wants to knock a party off the ballot can just find by state law or by the state party's processes a way to make sure that the party does not nominate any candidates for statewide office, and they can never get into the primary. And they may not qualify at all if they don't nominate candidates who can get even the lower threshold for staying on the ballot. But any libertarian who even ran for precinct delegate in about 6,000 precincts or so in the state, or is a close relative of one, or has been a party officer in the past, was it 5 years, I think it is, would not have qualified to even go in the pool to be selected for an independent seat on the redistricting commission. And if you look at it, actually, there are a lot of other commissions and boards at state level where the representation is decided by political party, and it's pretty well generally limited to the two major political parties, although Proposal 2 would now add a third definition of major political party to our laws, which is kind of interesting too.
Which would be independent?
For the redistricting commission, it's the two parties with the most seats in the state legislature would be major political parties. For campaign finance law, it's parties that get whose most recent candidates for governor get at least 25% of the vote. And if there aren't two of those, then the second place finisher gets it. But you could at least theoretically have three or even four major political parties for campaign finance laws. But it's Secretary of State race determines the major political parties for election law. And it's only the top two for them.
John LaPietra is the Green Party candidate in the 63rd State House District. That includes parts of both Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.